through employment, special order pricing, and more at drinkdragonfly.com. It's time for As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Under the weather, Florida is still recovering from the power of Hurricane Helene, and now Milton is heading directly towards Tampa. I'll speak with an aid worker getting ready to help those who won't be able to get out before that storm hits.
And trash pandemonium. All a Washington woman did was spend years putting out food for wild raccoons. So she was understandably shocked when her house was swarmed by dozens of expectant creatures who did not want to leave.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens on KAXC. Thanks for tuning in this evening. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Marie Debris, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. We receive support from Benders, offering name brand shoes, clothing, and gifts, with locations in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, and Duluth. BendersShoes.com, our family serving yours. Mostly clear overnight, lows in the mid-30s to low 40s, perhaps just a bit cooler on the Iron Range. Sunny tomorrow, highs 64 to 72, and southeast winds 5 to 15. Lows tomorrow night in the mid to upper 40s, and for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 72 to 80. You can answer our question of the week. What do you like to do with apples? Text us 218-326-1234. We heard this response. They said, I love caramel apples and have my own healthier version, which is cubing up an apple and pouring maple syrup over them and stirring it in a little yogurt. This makes a creamy caramel-like sauce that covers every bite. Yum. Let us know your apple thoughts. 218-326-1234. You can text that number. Let's take a listen now to our album of the week. It is Night Owls by J.D. McPherson. McPherson is known for his retro sound inspired by 1950s rock and roll, rockabilly, and rhythm and blues. This is his first album since 2018. He wanted to add sounds to the 80s, saying his original idea was surf rock band The Ventures as the backing band for early New Order. This gives the album a fresh sound, exploring the common threads that link different eras of music versus faithfully recreating a single time period. Let us know what you think of this album. Text in 218-326-1234. The song we'll hear this evening from J.D. McPherson is I Can't Go Anywhere With You.
Taking for sophistication for you.
from our album of the week, Night Owls by J.D. McPherson. That song's called I Can't Go Anywhere With You. Let us know what you think of the album. Text 218-326-1234 and read more about it at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
The fear before the storm as another powerful hurricane heads for Florida and residents jam highways trying to flee. I'll speak with a man who is ready to get help to those who aren't able to get out.
Hard to swallow. First Nations take the federal government to court, arguing it has a duty to ensure access to safe drinking water, while Ottawa argues that may be a laudable obligation, but it's not a legal one.
Throwing caution to the wind, Geoffrey Hinton receives the Nobel Prize for Physics for his pioneering work on AI, and he's taking that opportunity to again voice his concerns about that exact technology.
Pulling a robot out of a hat, an all-female team of grade 9 students works technological magic and wins first prize at a World Robotics Championship with a machine designed to combat wildfires.
Giving herself a lot of black eyes, everything seemed to be going great for a Washington woman who had spent decades feeding raccoons until 100 of them showed up at once. And guess what? They refused to leave.
And rough patch, thieves stole a giant pumpkin out of our guest's front yard, but unlike a jack-o'-lantern, he refuses to be gutted about it. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that knows no good deed goes unpunished. Florida is very familiar with hurricanes, but the one that's hurtling toward Tampa is threatening to be unlike anything the state has seen in a century. The Tampa Bay area is home to some 3 million people, many of whom are facing evacuation orders as Hurricane Milton approaches. Highways are jammed with people who've packed up their cars and are trying to leave, and long lines and empty pumps plagued gas stations across the region as officials, including U.S. President Joe Biden, urged Floridians to take the storm seriously.
If you're under evacuation orders, you should evacuate now. Now, now. You should have already evacuated. It's a matter of life and death, and that's not hyperbole. It's a matter of life and death.
Thomas Mance is the president and CEO of Feeding Tampa Bay, a nonprofit that provides food and other resources across West Central Florida. We reached him in Tampa.
Thomas, you heard it there. You've heard it before, I'm sure. President Biden saying now, now, now. Tampa's mayor says, quote, if you choose to stay in one of those evacuation areas, you're going to die, end quote. Are people heeding these warnings?
Yes, they are. I think as Helene went by, we anticipated some amount of impact, but not what we ended up having. The flooding was dramatic. And so I think because of that, folks have a far greater wariness about what the potential impact of Milton might be. And then on top of that, I think, as you're probably aware, this is the first storm, and I think over 100 years, that has been pointed directly at us here in Tampa Bay.
How would you describe what Tampa looks like today?
So as I sit here, I'm looking out the window, and the clouds are pretty significant, and they feel ominous, but it's not much different than a normal rainy day here. But boy, it sure feels like there's something out there waiting for us, right? You look out the window, and it has an ominous feel to it.
What is it like for you, personally, to see your home, your community, staring down the barrel of this storm?
I think our role at Feeding Tampa Bay is to look after our friends and neighbors. Mm-hmm. And so you always have a degree of anxiousness about that. You want to be there for folks. And so that's always in our minds as to how can we best be ready post-storm to pick up the pieces and help out and do our part to make sure our community is okay. And then you balance that against, you know, you have your own home and you want to make sure that people are tucked in and taken care of and safe as well. It's a challenge for sure to balance both of those.
How are people feeling? What are they telling you? This is a lot to deal with. And as you said, so soon after Helene.
You know, it's pretty interesting. There's a degree of anxiousness you can feel out in the community. There's a, you know, sense of common tension and awareness. You know, it reminds me of other national events that, you know, we've been through where everybody is talking about the same subject, and you can just feel and see if you're standing in a line somewhere or having conversations, there's an anxiousness and anxiety. I think for two reasons. One is because you know a storm is out there, but the other part of it is you really don't know what 24 to 36 hours is going to be like from now. And that uncertainty is very unsettling for, I think, all of us.
We know that there is already a broad swath of people experiencing food insecurity in Florida in terms of what you and your staff are hearing from clients about how they're bracing for this storm. What are they telling you?
You know, I think, thanks for pointing that out. Any kind of disaster like a hurricane hits folks who are of less economic means much harder. That means two things. One is some folks do not have the ability to leave, even though there are evacuation orders. They can only go to shelters or as far as their resources will take them. And so, you know, that's harder. And so some people stay because they can't economically make their way out. The other thing that happens is the recovery from a storm like this takes a long time, both in the, you know, the immediate needs are significant, but even over time, it takes families a while to rebuild what they lost. And so for folks who, again, struggle economically, storms are a equal opportunity in terms of its infliction upon a community, but its recovery for everybody is very different.
How do you jump in and your team to help when you were just helping people after Hurricane Helene? Like, what does that mean logistically and practically for all of you?
Well, as one of my colleagues says, you know, wash, rinse, repeat. We'll get up and do the same thing tomorrow that we've been doing, an elevated level of response. And to answer your question, we provide first and foremost food. That is the most important emergency response directly after a storm. But beyond that, we then start to bring other care services around someone because they may need access to federal benefits that are available to them in the aftermath of a storm. They may need other legal assistance. They may need a connection to other resources in our community. And, you know, we operate three or four different restaurants. We operate a grocery store. We operate the distributions in communities. We support 425 other nonprofit partners that help us in our community. So you add in all of the folks that will come into our care as a result of a storm, and it's quite a big lift we've been doing, and quite a bit more we're going to have to do.
What are you doing to safeguard your buildings, your operations?
Well, you know, as we talk today, we're 100 days in a brand new facility that we just completed construction in May. And part of the design of that facility took into account storms like this. And so we materially increased our capacity to take in and hold food and distribute it out. We built in disaster readiness around the facility. We even built in a significant kitchen so we can create far more prepared meals. And so, you know, we've already had one battle test of it through Helene. We'll have another one here with Milton. So, again, we're as prepared as we can be. You know, to be able to respond come hopefully Thursday afternoon or Friday morning.
Where are you going to be when the storm hits?
I personally haven't decided that quite yet. I may be on campus here. We'll see. I'm here now. Mm-hmm. Where, as I said, we've got a team of folks trying to get ready. But I'll see where is the best place for me to be during the storm. But I do want to make sure that I say this. I will be in good shape. I'm okay. My house is unlikely to be impacted, certainly not by water. It may be by wind. But I'll be in good shape. But thank you for asking that.
Of course. Thomas, I thank you for your time. Please take care.
We will. Thanks for having us on. We appreciate it.
Thomas Mance is the president and CEO of Feeding Tampa Bay. We reached him in Tampa, Florida. You might know him as one of the godfathers of artificial intelligence, or as the University of Toronto researcher who sounded the alarm about artificial intelligence, the threat posed by machines that may one day be smarter than we are. Now, Geoffrey Hinton will also be known as a Nobel Prize winner. He got the call from Sweden in the wee hours of the night telling him he's sharing this year's physics award with John Hopfield, another pioneer of artificial intelligence. We reached Geoffrey Hinton in Palo Alto, California.
Geoffrey Hinton, when you and I spoke on this program last year, you said you really kind of liked that Godfather title. How does it feel to add Nobel winner?
I'm still sort of semi in shock. I was very surprised. It's good.
That might be the understatement of the century. It's good. But I hear you. It's still sinking in. You've been on the program a few times, and back in 2019, you talked about how early on people dismissed you. Given where we are now, where you are now, what you've achieved, what does it say to you that there were so many doubts about your work at that time?
I guess for about 50 years, AI was dominated by the symbolic AI approach, which assumed that we worked by having strings of symbols in our heads, which we manipulated with rules. And the idea was we must somehow work like logic. That's the only way you could think. It was just wrong, that's all.
Did you care at that time that people were dismissing you?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, they didn't have any theory of how the brain worked, and it was obvious that the brain didn't work like that. The brain was a great big network of neurons, and we had to figure out how great big networks of neurons could actually learn things. And that always seemed to me a problem that obviously needed to be solved.
You're being recognized for this work, or this important work, but I think a lot of people, certainly in the last couple of years, through conversations like the one we've had and other interviews you've done, people have come to know you as one of the loudest voices warning the world about the risks that AI poses to all of us. How do you balance that in your mind? How does it sit with you that what you helped pioneer, what you're being honored for now, might also one day become incredibly destructive?
It's quite worrying. Mm-hmm. We've never before had to deal with things more intelligent than ourselves. And most researchers now believe that sometime in the next 20 years, possibly earlier, we're going to be able to produce things more intelligent than ourselves. And there's a big issue about whether we're going to be able to control them. There are very few examples in nature of more intelligent things being controlled by less intelligent things. In fact, the only example I know is a mother and baby, where evolution put a huge amount of work into allowing the baby to control the mother.
You said you want governments to force big companies, big corporations, to fund safety research around AI. How are you feeling about the likelihood of that happening, that the best young minds, maybe some who have learned from you, will get what they need to find ways to prevent the kind of worst-case scenario that you're painting?
I think as people gradually get to grips with the idea that we're going to be producing beings that are more intelligent than us, they'll realize we have to figure out how people can stay in control. We're people, and what we like is people, and we would like people to stay in control.
What are your greatest hopes for AI?
I think AI can do tremendous good if we can manage to avoid the dangers. So in healthcare, for example, it would be great to have a family doctor who'd seen 100 million patients and knew everything about them and knew everything about all their relatives and knew your whole genome. We're going to get that, but we have to be careful that this stuff doesn't get out of control, and we have to be careful of all the other bad possible side effects of it. Like things like discrimination and bias, yeah. Things like lethal autonomous weapons. All of those things are things we have to stay in control of and worry about. But the upside is so good, there's no chance that people will stop developing AI.
Have you seen a shift since you first started speaking out last year and doing all of those interviews, having those conversations, issuing those warnings? Have you seen things that make you feel better about the direction things are going in?
Yes, governments are beginning to take notice. I've been quite impressed by the fact many government leaders are kind of worried about this and interested in it. The actions aren't nearly serious enough yet, and I was quite disappointed that the governor of California vetoed a bill that was one of the first bills that would have had some teeth. But I think progress is being made.
The Nobel Prize, of course, comes with generous prize money. When you won the Turing Award, you said you planned to use some of the money from that to fund the humanities at the University of Toronto and for an organization that provides jobs for autistic adults. Have you thought about what you might want to do this time with your winnings?
I'm going to carry on providing money for the organization that helps autistic adults, but I probably am going to give it to some other causes as well, but I don't know what.
There's time still. Why is funding that supporting autistic adults so important to you?
I have a son who has learning difficulties. And for families with children with learning difficulties, having their children get jobs is very, very significant advance.
You said before that you don't think too much about legacy. You don't worry too much about it because you can't take it with you. I think you told Toronto Life that last year. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah. I'm not too worried about legacy. I won't be there to see it. It's not... For some reason, I don't particularly care about my legacy. I care about what happens now.
It's really interesting because people who often do this kind of seminal work, whether it's in your field or others, that's a big part of why they do it, what they want to leave behind, what they want to be remembered for. But it sounds like even though this is still sinking in, that's not a motivation.
I don't think so. Obviously, it'd be nice to be sort of remembered, but I don't think it's a big deal. I got invited by a library in Toronto to put all my papers together and stuff, and I just wasn't interested.
Oh, really? What if people want to remember the work you did and learn more about you?
I think they'll be able to do that.
Understood. Jeffrey Hinton, a pleasure speaking with you again. Thank you for making time for us, and congratulations.
Thank you again. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Jeffrey Hinton is one of this year's winners of the Nobel Prize for Physics. He's in Palo Alto, California. David Lindsay had something important to him in his front yard. It was big and heavy and beautiful, and he had helped create it. But then this weekend, in the dead of night, a theft. One of his prized pair of gigantic pumpkins was gone. When I say gigantic, I mean it. They weigh more than 108 kilograms or 240 pounds each. We reached David Lindsay at home in West Kelowna, B.C.
David, how are people there reacting to this news, this pumpkin theft?
Well, I'm quite shocked by it, actually. It's garnered way more attention than I would have ever expected. You know, it's funny, if I had told people, oh, somebody stole my car, it would have been, yeah, okay. But when you tell them somebody stole your pumpkin, they take it very personally.
Well, I mean, don't you take it personally? We're talking about this prize pumpkin.
Well, you know, I grow these pumpkins for my grandchildren. They live over on the island. And I did it a couple of years ago, and I'm doing it again, of course. And I have some pumpkins there, and two in particular grew very large. One was roadside, sort of behind a tree. And it grew, and it grew, and it grew. And it's become a little bit of a celebrity. I mean, people walking down the street have been posing with it, and kids, and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, oh, I know that thing's vulnerable. I was going to put a sign there saying, I'm growing this for my grandchildren, please don't steal it.
Oh, so you had a hunch.
But no, it went.
Oh, no. Well, how are your grandchildren reacting?
Well, I asked my son about that, and he says, yeah, they were a little heartbroken. Oh. But you know what? Maybe that's a good lesson. I mean, life's not always fair. So we still have one remaining pumpkin Grandpa can take over.
You had a hunch that, you know, these were attractive to passersby, not just because for their Instagram posts. You thought this might happen, but like we said, we're talking about 240 pounds here. How do you think they did this? How did they pull this off?
Well, you know, I've got cameras on my house. We actually went through it. I can see Saturday morning at 1:06 in the morning, there was some activity there, but not enough light that you could make out bodies. And, you know, when you get a pumpkin of that size, they're a little awkward to lift. So I think it's got to be at least three big people to pick it up. You know, look, it's a little discouraging, but I'm just laughing it off. If these are your biggest problems in life, you don't have much to complain about, do you?
Yeah, well, that's a great way. It's a really great way to think about it. Are there any leads at this point? Any idea who might have done this?
No, and I really don't expect them, you know. But the shocking part really is people's reactions. And it's really got me reflecting on that. And I think it's because we all reflect back to our childhood. You know, we remember carving pumpkins and cleaning them out, you know, the seeds out. And we remember that the smell in those days where you put a candle in it and the candle would burn the lid of the pumpkin. And, you know, so I think this is why people take it so personally.
Yeah, it's also stealing. But yes, and your reasons for doing it, for growing them, were so personal. And they were part of the community, too.
Yes.
You're taking some measures to make sure the second one is protected. What are you doing?
Well, I injured my back about a month ago.
Oh, no.
And so I can't, the remaining one, these two pumpkins, I can't pick them up. So I contacted my buddies and I said, hey guys, I need help picking these things up. How about I put a roast beef dinner on? They were all in. Like, okay. So I have a light on it now so that the camera would pick up any intruders.
Okay.
But apart from that, I might have to move my schedule up.
Getting it off your property in the dead of night is one thing. What do you think they want to do with it? I mean, everybody there knows about this giant pumpkin that's gone missing.
Well, you know, it's all speculation, isn't it? I mean, it would be easy to speculate and say, well, these are some high school kids that are picking it up and maybe they're going to go have a party in the bush or something. I have no idea, but it certainly is celebrity. I mean, even today, pulling into my driveway, I've got construction workers out front, and they're like, hey, you're the guy with the pumpkin, right? <You know>? So it just kind of has a connection with people. I mean, it's very peculiar. Very peculiar.
If there's suddenly a giant sale on pies or a pop-up pie shop... I don't know.
I don't know if they would make a good pie or not.
Which is too big? Not flavorful enough?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know. These giant Atlantic pumpkins, do they make good pie? One thing's for sure, it would make a lot of pies.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. So the second one, when you do get it to your grandchildren, is the plan to carve it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's large enough that it's going to require some power tools, I think.
Yeah. So you're going to do this again next year?
I think we will. As a matter of fact, I belong to a group of people who are all sailors, and I'm thinking, why don't we all grow these things next year, and then maybe we can have a little, because we're on the lake here, Lake Okanagan, we'll have a little gourd gada where we paddle pumpkins for charity, because if it garners that much attention, maybe we can use it for some good.
You are securing your spot in the As It Happens lineup next year already. Congratulations.
Just a lot of fun. You might as well make lemonade, right?
Yes. Or pumpkin pie, whatever.
Or whatever.
David, a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too.
That was David Lindsay. He's in West Kelowna, BC. You had a great meal together, you had some great laughs, and when you choked while laughing, one of your guests saved your life, and then you laughed some more. So as they leave, your heart is as full as your stomach, and you say, come back anytime, there's no need to contact me first, my door is always open. Over the years, you do this over and over with dozens of different people. But you're sure everyone knows you're just a little tipsy and you're relieved at not choking to death. They won't take you up on that offer and just stop by unannounced. But then, one night... Why, who could that be? Are people knocking at your front and back doors? What exactly is... Oh no, it's happening. Everyone you ever invited to drop by has dropped by at the same time, and they're hungry. This is what just happened to a woman who lives near Poulsbo, Washington. For decades, she's been hosting very successful dinner parties, but recently she had to call the local police because nearly 100 of her prior guests showed up at the same time, demanding to be fed. They can't knock, luckily, because raccoons don't have knuckles. The unnamed woman said she'd been feeding the raccoons on her property for around 35 years, just a few at a time, usually, but then, 6 weeks ago, dozens of them showed up at once and did not leave. Video shows these 100 or so raccoons sitting expectantly in her yard, unbothered by the presence of the law, because on that property, the raccoons are the law. The police referred the woman to the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, which might be able to help her. Let's hope someone can, because those raccoons are not about to knuckle under due to, yeah, as I mentioned, their lack of knuckles. Here's Hungry Lake with Raccoon. With Raccoon.
All I will say is just do not do this. I've heard of this happening in Toronto. Please
do not feed.
Yes, and do not bring raccoon content onto the show. He loves them. Maybe we send them to your house.
This is an ongoing.
I can send you the address.
Tete-a-tete.
And
between Neil and I.
To add insult to injury, it is World Octopus Day. Let us talk about them. Yeah.
I apologize to the octopuses.
Yeah. As you
and
should.
To you.
Yeah, but you love raccoons.
I do.
So I don't know that apology is sincere.
They're gutsy. They're resourceful.
They're gutsy.
And threatening in this particular instance.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, well, stay tuned, everybody. I'm Chris Houghton.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Marie Debris is your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, proudly serving the Grand Rapids area for 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. We also thank the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. They are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. Weather tonight, mostly clear, lows in the mid-30s to low 40s, and tomorrow, sunny, highs 64 to 72, winds from the southeast 5 to 15. Sunny on Thursday with highs 72 to 80.
You might expect that all the legal battles over safe drinking water in this country would be over by now. For one thing, Canada is a wealthy country. For another, it's been 3 years since Ottawa committed nearly $8 billion to settle two major class actions with First Nations. But this week, the federal government is in court battling another claim. The new class action began with Shamattawa First Nation, a fly-in community in northern Manitoba that has been under a boil water advisory since 2018. And since the suit was certified last year, more than 50 other First Nations have signed on, seeking over $1 billion in damages. Michael Rosenberg is representing Shamattawa First Nation. He made his arguments at a hearing yesterday. Today, he listened to the federal government's lawyers make their submissions. We reached him during a break in the proceedings in Ottawa this afternoon.
Michael, we know the federal government's lawyers have released a statement of defense. You're expecting to hear more details on that in court today. What are you expecting to hear from those lawyers?
Well, thus far, what we've heard from Canada has been pretty technical. And we haven't yet gotten to the heart of their defense. But as I understand it, they'll be arguing that class members, First Nations and their members that have lived for more than a year under a drinking water advisory, the class members don't have a right to safe drinking water on their reserves. But safe drinking water is a matter of good governance, perhaps, but not a right. And they're going to be explained to the court why they say it is that there's no fiduciary duties owed, no duties of care, no rights under the charter that would apply to class member situation.
Quote, a matter of good governance rather than legal duty, unquote, according to that statement of defense. When you hear that statement, what do you take from it?
Well, it's not so much me as my clients. Mm-hmm. We act for Chief Jordan Hill of Shamattawa First Nation. Chief Hill and his community have been living under a drinking water advisory since 2018. And they continue to live under advisory to this day. And they have depended on the federal government to help them through this water crisis. And they've been disappointed. And to explain to folks like the people of Shamattawa, it's a matter of good governance. It's a gratuitous act of the government. At a certain point, that's just not good enough anymore.
They had potable water on Shamattawa First Nation before 2018. What happened then?
So they had a regular access to safe drinking water. They've had the same water treatment plant since 1999. Mm-hmm. And remember, this is a community that only got running water in homes in the 1990s. But they've had that water treatment plant since 1999, and it has consistently experienced failures because the water intake is at the confluence of two rivers, and seasonally it clogs and the plant fails. And at other times during the year, they grapple with contamination issues. And so, it's true that they did at one point have water from their taps. It was never relationship to water that you or I might experience in a city. And in recent years, as you've heard, it's been considerably worse. Community members have experienced all sorts of health challenges. We heard from the evidence, so many community members talking about skin lesions, the rashes, stomach sickness, and it takes a toll psychologically. We've heard significant evidence of depression, of really feeling like second-class citizens in this country.
As our listeners heard, Michael, there have been other lawsuits which you've been part of. You argued in the previous two, the government settled $8 billion in total in terms of those settlements. Why do you think the federal government is fighting this suit?
You know, it's something of a mystery to my clients. We worked well with the federal government in resolving the previous class actions in 2021. I give credit where credit is due. The federal government came to the table in the spirit of partnership with First Nations and reached what I thought at the time was a historic accord, which not only provided compensation, not only promised infrastructure spending, but also recognized the commitment the federal government was making to stand with First Nations and ensure they had the resources they needed to provide safe drinking water to their people. But it's a different experience this time around. And as much as our clients have been at the table and looking for a nation-to-nation discussion around safe drinking water, they have not received any offer from the federal government. It's obviously not too late to change, but thus far, Shimato has had no option but to come to court.
There have been, as I understand it, some upgrades, or in the works at least, upgrades to Shamattawa's water treatment plant. Ottawa has spent, as I understand it, upwards of $25 million on making those changes. That is a lot of money by anyone's account. What's the problem? Why isn't that money helping?
So there has been significant investment in Shamattawa's water treatment plant. But the bigger picture is what's concerning, which is that even once that addition to the water treatment plant is completed, the new design will not address the basic problem that I mentioned a moment ago as to where the water intake is and the risks inherent in locating the water intake where it is. And that's a real concern to Shamattawa. Once they get the solution, the problem persists, and that's reflective in part of the fact that First Nations, although they are notionally the owners of their water systems, are significantly dependent on the federal government and its involvement in the funding, but also the design and ultimately the operation and maintenance of those water systems. First Nations, many of which understand very well the solutions that they need, are often left out of the process or given a token role. And that's perpetuated a water crisis, whereby at this very moment, there are still 33 long-term drinking water advisories.
You are arguing safe drinking water in Canada should be recognized as a fundamental right. The government is saying it's a laudable goal, but not one it's legally obligated to fulfill. What needs to change, Michael, so you're not back in court again in another 3 years?
Well, what we hope, and certainly what our clients have asked for, is that the federal court recognize a right, not to a result. No one can guarantee a result, but a right to Canada's best efforts, and a recognition of rights, a declaration of First Nations rights, would allow them to understand what they can expect from Ottawa, and in turn, allow Ottawa to understand its duties to First Nations. My hope is that we avoid these sorts of discussions in the future, and First Nations will be able to enjoy the same kind of access to drinking water that most Canadians take for granted.
Michael, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show, Neil.
Michael Rosenberg is a lawyer representing Shamattawa First Nation, which has been without safe drinking water since 2018. We reached him in Ottawa. We contacted Indigenous Services Canada, who sent us a statement that read in part, quote, "Everyone in Canada should have access to reliable, safe, and clean drinking water," and went on to point to the proposed First Nations Clean Water Act as a measure to help hold government to account. For years, Sally Field was hesitant to tell the story, but in the run-up to this particular U.S. presidential election, she's decided to share it, and share it as widely as possible. When she was a teenager, she got pregnant, and with limited options, she had to travel to seek an abortion. Ms. Field first told that story in a 2018 memoir. And this week, the Oscar-winning actress detailed the experience in an Instagram video, encouraging American voters to cast their ballots for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz. Here's some of what she said, and I will warn you that some of the details are upsetting.
I was 17. I had graduated from high school, but had no one ever said, go, how about college? How about, you know, I had nothing. I didn't know what was going to be. And then I found out I was pregnant. Luckily, I had a family doctor who was a friend of the family. And he drove me and his wife and my mother to Tijuana. And we parked on a really scrungy looking street, scary. And he parked about three blocks away and said, see that building down there? And he gave me an envelope with money. And I was to walk into that building and give them the cash and then come right back to him. And I guess he thought if I were dying, maybe he could help me. And it was beyond hideous and life altering. I had no anesthetic. There was a technician giving me a few puffs of ether, but he would then take it away. So it just made my arms and legs feel numb and weird. But I felt everything, how much pain I was in. And then I realized that the technician was actually molesting me. So I had to figure out how can I make my arms move to push him away. And then when it was finished, they said, go, 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 like the building was on fire. And they didn't want me there. It was illegal, you know. And my doctor, I'm sure his generosity and his bravery, because he would have lost his license, you know, if anyone had found out, and more probably, because I was too naive to know anything. I had never been out of the state. I'd never been on an airplane. And fate reached in, and a few months after that, I began auditioning, and by the end of that year, I was Gidget. I was the quintessential all-American girl next door. I was the quintessential all-American girl next door because so many young women, my generation of women, were going through this. And these are the things that women are going through now. It's beyond how you can go back to that and not have respect and regard for their health and their own decisions about whether they feel they're able to give birth to a child at that time. We can't go back. We can't go back.
Actress Sally Field speaking in a video posted to Instagram this week. A team of robotics experts recently returned to Canada after coming down on their opponents like an automaton of bricks. The Forest Guardians just won first prize at the World Robot Olympiad in Italy, making them the first ever Canadian champions at the event. It took them months of working through lunch breaks, meeting after school, and getting special permission to use their school library so they could meet over the summer. All four Forest Guardians are students who are now in grade 9, and their prize-winning robot is a wildfire-fighting phenom called Blazebot. Chathak Kaur and Melanie Rose Ramcharan are both members of the team. Priya Parikh is a teacher and the Guardians' head coach, and we reached them all in Mississauga, Ontario.
Chathak, Melanie, first of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
How are you feeling?
Amazing.
What is it like to be back? Chathak, I'll ask you first, after this incredible win and adventure.
It is honestly so amazing. The trip was amazing. When I was like, as soon as I came back, all my friends, all my peers and classmates, they all congratulated me. They were all so happy for me, and I was like over the moon. I was so happy.
I can imagine. I hope you keep that feeling for a really long time. Melanie, what about you? What's it like to be back as an international champion?
I feel the same as Chathak. All of my peers and teachers, they all congratulated me. it makes me feel really happy now that we've accomplished something like this.
And you are two members of a four-person team. You did this together. You worked for a long time. There is a fifth member of the gang, and that certainly is your teacher, Priya. Mm-hmm. Priya, let me bring you in. How are you feeling? I mean, is proud a sufficient word?
I would say it encompasses a part of how I feel about all four girls, Chitra Sekri and Rupanya Anand, alongside Chatik and Melanie, have just blown it. Everybody out of the water in terms of their accomplishments. They started with such a humble beginning and then kind of worked their way through like one competition after the other, and we just kept hearing like first place, and we were all just like flabbergasted, just shocked. And you know, we were just couldn't believe it. We had like, right girls, we had like this like, are you for real? This is happening? Wow. Like, I guess really we have something, you know, and we just had so much fun. And myself and Lydia Marcelli, the librarian, really had a hand in helping the girls, you know, bring to life this robot.
And we should point out your classroom is a French immersion classroom. The presentation,
right,
I believe, was done in French overseas. How did robotics, Priya, enter the equation in the first place?
Actually, it started at a higher level. We had Aaron Coulson, who is the PDSB instructional coordinator in FSL and international languages. She's awesome. She had reached out and had said, like, you know, let's try this initiative where we can see if we can introduce robotics into the classroom. And I jumped at the opportunity, and I knew it was like sort of like a almost like a pilot idea. It was in its early stages, and I have some background in coding and like a little bit of knowledge, but by no means do I have like tons of it. But I just threw myself in the deep end, went to some workshops alongside Lydia, my librarian, and we really like taught ourselves, and we brought it to the FI classroom, and the kids just loved it. You know, for a change, we were doing these having these engaging conversations that our English counterparts were having, and bringing those really unique conversations to our FI classrooms instead of them being just not as engaging.
And Chatik, how exactly does BlazeBot work?
So on BlazeBot, our final prototype, we have three sensors. We have a CO2 sensor, a flame sensor, and a temperature/humidity sensor. And all of these sensors and all of these characteristics are the kind of the beginning of a fire. So when a fire first starts, all of these factors are shown that will detect when a fire will essentially start. And if the temperature is higher than we have set, it will send a message via the Bluetooth modules that we have placed, one on the robot and one at a fire station. It will send it wirelessly to the fire station, which will then receive the data and make a light turn on.
And so then you go to the competition in Italy.
Yeah.
You go through all the rounds. You're in the final round. I mean, are you thinking at that stage that you're going to win?
Honestly, in the final stage of the competition, we had no idea. We were honestly looking around at the other robots, and we were thinking that our robot would not even have a chance. The other robots to us looked so much bigger and so much better, but our idea, our robot actually won, which was amazing. We thought that our robot was okay. Maybe would place maybe fifth, maybe seventh, maybe at least top 10. We would never think that it would place first place.
And Melanie, what about you? Did you think you were, you know, going to be first? Were there nerves throughout?
No, I really didn't think that we would be able to do that.
Yeah.
But being first place was just such a big surprise. It was so exciting.
I wish I could have been there to see that moment. What did it look like? What did it feel like?
So when the woman announcing all the winners, when she said our team's name, we were just like all jumping and screaming, shouting. We were so excited. We went up and we got the trophy and everything, and it was just wow.
Yeah, wow. Priya, I wonder for you, what do you think set your students apart? Obviously, you're biased, but as you were looking out at all the other competitors, what do you think set them apart?
I don't know. It was just like these girls. This was a very humbling experience, I think, for us and the team. Like, there was like 47 countries there. You know, I think what set the girls apart was the fact that they worked together as a team and that they had countless rehearsals. And we really took this like a Shark Tank pitch. Like, we were like, we're going to town with this. We're going to make sure that we're going to solve the wildfires that are like plaguing Montreal, California, Vancouver. You know, we talked about how they had even like, you know, had wildfires in the Amazon, and that the cost was too great to not have a solution to help our firefighters. And so they really like took it very personally, and they really, really put all their passion, their effort, their time into this project.
Well, you all have a lot to be proud of. Congratulations again, Priya, Chathuk, Melanie. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We reached Chathuk Kaur, Melanie Rose Ramcharan, and Priya Parekh in Mississauga, Ontario. Blocks are falling from the sky, all of them different shapes. They fall faster and faster, relentlessly, and you must arrange them in perfect rows or risk losing it all. It sounds like a nightmare. It is kind of a nightmare, but it's also the classic video game Tetris, a game so stressful that just hearing this music makes me want to clench my fists and scream and just pound my hands. Thank you. Thank you. That's so much better. And you know, anyway, that music would have made it hard for you to hear this. It was still stressful. This is the sound of 16-year-old American Tetris champ Michael Arteaga live streaming what turned out to be a history-making Tetris game. Now, Tetris has long been considered unbeatable. At a certain point, the blocks just fall too quickly for any human to keep up. But Mr. Arteaga, whom you probably know by his screen name Dog Playing Tetris or Dog Playing or just Dog, has availed himself of new techniques like rolling and hyper-tapping. I don't know what those are, and I would be bad at using them if I did. But they've allowed players to reach heretofore unreachable levels. And now, the highest level.
Yes! Yes! Oh my god! I actually cannot believe it, bro! I can't believe it, dude! I cannot believe it! I am, if you didn't know already, I am in disbelief! Oh my gosh! We're back at level 0. Oh my god, am I dreaming, bro?
No, bro. You were not dreaming. And neither were you out there. That was the sound of Michael Arteaga, a.k.a. Dog Playing Tetris, a.k.a. Dog Playing, a.k.a. Dog, beating Tetris and becoming the first player to achieve rebirth. Not necessarily the spiritual kind, but definitely the kind in which the game resets and starts all over again, proving endless play is possible. For him, but not for the rest of us who, let's face it, just are not on his level.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.